Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We are welcoming in Joel Sherman from the New York Post to talk for the rest of the program. And Joel has written a terrific article that I just loved yesterday about Greg Jeffries. And welcome in, Joel. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Richard. How about yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good. You know, I was talking about Harry Bosch before the Michael Connelly series, and Harry Bosch at this point in his career is doing cold cases. And that's kind of what you're doing now. You're taking stories, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say, from things that happened in the past because there's nothing really to write about now necessarily. And we'll get into some of the stuff, but, the old stuff. And I was wondering, what inspired you to dig into the Greg Jeffries tale?
Well, does that mean I started with Black Echo like Michael Connelly did on the
House? Ah, Michael Connelly fan. Good stuff.
you're right. Look, if there were baseball games yesterday, I wouldn't have written about Greg Jeffries. But there's not, and we're trying to keep at the New York Post a vibrant, vital sports section. So one of the things I'm doing is, all of us are doing, is we're trying to mine the past for what's entertaining, enlightening, and also might shine some light on our present. I did this several weeks ago. I wrote a equally long piece about Drew Henson, who I always found fascinating as kind of the greatest athlete who never was, a guy who couldn't miss in both sports and did. I kind of find that storyline fascinating. And in that same way, I always found Jeffries fascinating. In the late 80s, early 90s, from 1989 to 95, I was actually the Yankee beat writer for the Post. But I'm aware of what's going on the other side of town, and Jeffries feels very much like the can't-miss guy coming up. And obviously the Mets had a lot of this, and Strawberry and Gooden and a few others who never kind of like fully flowered the way they should have. And many of those players' stories are well-known. And I've always been fascinated why the Jeffries thing didn't work. It was obvious there was a lot of reporting in real time that he didn't get along with his teammates. And so I decided, could I go revisit that by talking to Jeffries? And just as important, talking to some of the guys on his team. And if you read the piece, I hope you did, is you notice it's like, I really do think he ended up being wrong place, wrong time guy. Without boring your listeners, just I'll do one of them, wrong time. Greg Jeffries shows up in 2018 or 2017 instead of 1987, 1988. He's very much like the players who play now. The guys who are drafted in America now are guys who play travel ball a lot. They have their own routines. They have their own tutors. The idea of being different and away from the team is not that big a deal. Having your own bats, having your own bat bags, that's just routine now. In 1988, that was all looked at as against the code of how guys came to the sport, which was, hey, rookie, you're here to be seen and not heard. Shut up. Don't step on any toes. And Greg Jeffries didn't fit that profile in 1988. And I just always wondered, if he came along in 2018, does he have a completely different career?
Interesting. And you talk about the bats and how Keith Hernandez was actually angry that Greg Jeffries would rub down his bats with alcohol after games to clean them, which seems a little anal, but whatever. But it was actually offensive to those old school guys, and they made a big deal out of it.
Well, in some ways, it feels a little bit like going out of your way to find something that annoys you. But, I talked to Keith, and, full transparency, I've known Keith for a very long time, and I like Keith a lot. And Keith actually told me he would use alcohol to clean his bats, but the superstition then was not to do it after the game, the idea that you're wiping hits off of it. So again, think about the difference between 1988 and 2020. If somebody said that today, it would hit the ear as bizarre. In 88. It did not. But then he told Jeffries, hey, if you're going to do it right after the game, face the clubhouse instead of facing your locker. Again, if somebody says it today, you know, you're like, what difference does it make? But, I mean, I'll give Jeffries the credit for what he said, which was, I came into their world and I didn't exactly figure out how to mix in with it. And like anything, I could probably tell you newspaper stories from the mid-80s or early 90s, or you could tell me radio stories from then about how things were done. And if we looked back now, we'd say, that's crazy. But that's how it was done. And so we could decide, were the guys who were doing it, were they wrong? Or was the guy who didn't mix in and appreciate that's how it was done, was he wrong? And what I found fascinating talking to these guys 30 years later is they both took responsibility. Jeffries was, don't blame them. I should have figured it out. And these guys, especially David Cohn and Ron Darling to some extent, you know, Ron Darling used the term Neanderthals to describe who those players were in the late 80s and not able to appreciate that somebody could be different. So I thought that was fascinating as well.
Yeah, yeah. And Ron Darling, you know, doesn't exempt himself from all of that. And, I mean, he talked the controversial Lenny Dykstra thing about how he baited oil can Boyd and Dykstra went back at him and all of that. But, you know, Ron Darling seems to have matured an awful lot and has a very good perspective on the Ron Darling of 1986 and the 80s to the Ron Darling of today.
Yeah, and look, I thought one of the things that all the key players I talked to, which were McDowell, Hernandez, Cohn, Darling, I spoke a little to Mark Carrion, I talked to Joe McElvay, a few others, but I thought those four star-level players, I thought one of the things they said, which is fascinating, was they didn't recognize in the moment that the team had already kind of played its best games and was coming apart, that Keith and Gary Carter had kind of were getting old and not star-level players anymore. You know, Doc and Strawberry were going through their problems. They still thought they were the 84 to 87, 84 to 88 mess, and they weren't. And Jeffries and guys like Dave Magadan, they were supposed to be the bridge to the next good team. But the old team didn't want to let go. Right, and here comes Greg Jeffries. They trade Wally Backman to create a position for him. Then they to kind of clear up the outfield, they trade Dykstra for Juan Samuel. Instead of putting Juan Samuel at his natural position, second base, they force feed him into center field, which he really can't play. All of this is being done for Jeffries. That only makes it worse for Jeffries. He has this perception in his own clubhouse as the golden child, the guy they'll do things for. But I think one of the things, again, we know with 2020 hindsight about 30 years ago was the 1989 Mets thought they were still the 1986 Mets, and they were not. But they didn't know it in the time, and they saw this guy as somebody ripping apart, right? Because part of the Dykstra trade is McDowell gets traded also. So you have McDowell, Dykstra, and Backman, all key core members of that team, moving on to accommodate second base to some degree for Jeffries, who already is a difficult kind of personality in their clubhouse and making it all the tougher for them.
And you know, the interesting thing, too, that I found fascinating in the article was the difference in dads. I mean, we know Keith Hernandez talks about his father, and his father was really tough on him and a taskmaster. And, you know, Keith looks back at it now and says, yeah, my dad was the best thing for me. But he was that old school, you know, tough love type dad, whereas it seems Greg Jeffries' dad was the more modern dad from today, where they're more accommodating and more accepting and much more, I don't want to say coddling necessarily, but a different kind of dad than Keith and the others were brought up with.
Well, Richard, I would say this, is there's a real split in whether that is accurate or not. That is how Greg Jeffries portrays his father. It is not how the players and the managers and the coaches and the executives at the time, they felt that the father was very much a helicopter, hover, critical father. Ah. The way Jeffries disseminated it was that he was helpful, that my father was my best friend, the guy who, you know, he wasn't forcing me to do something I didn't want to do. He loved baseball, that the training sessions, you know, there's a very famous, I cite it in the story. There's a very famous Sports Illustrated story from, I believe it's spring of 88 or 89. I think it's spring of 89 about the workout that Rich Jeffries had created for Greg. And there was like 16 or 17 different stations to it. And it lasted pretty much all day, 6 days a week. You know, most famously what came out of that was that he had Greg swing a bat underwater in the family swimming pool to kind of, you know, create bat speed, you know, strengthen his wrist, et cetera. And so that 30 years ago was looked at poorly. But kind of the underlying thing was 6 days a week you're doing these workouts with your father. Where is that normal kind of progression as a, you know, middle school, high school kid where you learn to integrate with others? And I think people around the Mets would say a not fully formed human being showed up, and that's where the wrong place comes in, right? If you were going to have a kid who was insular, who had a pretty healthy regard for himself, who was a daddy's boy, was going to show up in 1987, 88 someplace, I think the last place you would want to put him is A, New York, and B, on those Mets, who were brutal. I mean, the one thing that is consistent about that team is people talking about how brutal they were to each other. And it created kind of this strange loyalty to the core group, which, again, if you were someone who was coming in to burst the old group like Jeffries was, it would be a problem. But that was not a, hey, we're going to put our arm around you and teach you how to be a major leaguer. It was, we're going to throw you in the middle of the pool and we might throw some weights in also, and let's see how you swim.
Yeah, Dodgers might have been a little bit different in their approach to that. Another very key thing here is the letter. And I don't even remember that. Was it 91 where it was the open letter where Greg Jeffries took his teammates to task? And Jeffries tells you now, I didn't write that letter. Somebody else did. And he wouldn't tell you who wrote it. I imagine you probably did a little bit of research to try to figure it out. Any fruit there, or is it always going to be a mystery?
Yeah, I think if you did some digging, it probably isn't that much of a mystery. I will say that whether he wrote it or not, you know, it was written in his behalf, and I would assume that if he wanted to lay himself across the train tracks and stop it, he could have stopped it. And he chose not to stop it. I think one of the things that comes up, Richard, when I researched this piece, and I mean, I was reading weeks and weeks worth of old newspaper copy from that era, is the total, I mean, first of all, how prominent newspapers were then. I'm sad to say, you know, where things are have evolved over the time. Guys talked every day, quite frankly, quite brutally, about each other, about management, and the things that are said about Greg Jeffries. You talk about forgetting that this letter was read on your air. I mean, I have covered baseball in New York since the mid-80s, Richard. I have now forgotten, with all the media training vanilla nonsense we now get from everybody, that players actually used to be quite frank about how they were feeling. And that is what's startling, to the point where somebody would feel compelled to write a 9-paragraph open letter and have it read on the 50,000-watt all-sports station in town about their feeling. And so, about how they're being mistreated by their teammates. So, I mean, it is bizarre to go back and read how players used to talk about, and by the way, managers, front offices used to talk about their players. It's 30 years ago, and it feels like not the same sport, not the same couple of decades.
Yeah, I mean, I made the point earlier in the hour, but Davey Johnson would criticize players, and you get a manager now. You know, they call him throw him under the bus. A manager who does that now is excoriated. How dare you point the finger at your players? You know, that's wrong. And yet back then, it was pretty common practice with Davey and others.
Well, Davey complained that Greg Jeffries, after he made an out, would walk back too slowly to the dugout. In other words, that he was self-absorbed with his particular result without caring about the full extent of the team. You know, sometimes, you know, like they'd want Jeffries if he was hitting, say, number one after the pitcher or number two after the pitcher had been out. Hey, get up there slow, take a pitch. Nope, Jeffries rushed to the plate and swung at the first pitch. I mean, there were all these things about Jeffries that, you know, if it's a player you personally like, you look at him as eclectic. If it's a player who you don't like, you're annoyed by every little scratch on the chalkboard. That's what it becomes to you. And clearly, there was something about Jeffrey. Look, I covered this kind of player who was great, right? There was something about Alex Rodriguez. You know, we could have all kinds of, you know, like it's beyond the PED talk, Richard. But there was something about Alex that drove teammates crazy. And, like, it would be hard to put your finger on it. I covered Bobby Valentine. There was something about Bobby Valentine that drove his players crazy. There are just people who the way they carry themselves, is there a certain kind of arrogance, insecurity, something that drives other people nuts. And clearly, Jeffries had that aura about him and kind of made it wrong place, wrong time for him to be a Met in the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, Joel, you can boil it down to elitism. When somebody gives off the vibe that they're better than you, they're better looking, they're smarter, they're more talented, people resent that, even if it's true, even if they, in their heart of hearts, they'll admit, yeah, this guy's got it over me. They don't like feeling that way. They feel like they're holding it over you, and they resent you as a result.
Yeah, I would wonder if the underlying commonality there is more insecurity than elitism, but I'm sure we could, me, you, and Dr. Freud could have long conversations about it. But clearly, whatever it was, Greg Jeffries had great talent. He is the first baseball, he is the first kind of like star of the Baseball America era. He's their player of the year 2 years in a row. He could run. He could hit. He was a switch hitter who had a mirror swing from both sides of the plate. Joe McElvain talks about like five players who he thought were can't miss. And the other guys are people like A-Rod and Manny Ramirez and Gary Sheffield and Ken Griffey. And the fifth is Jeffries. And, you know, this is a guy who saw thousands players. He thought this player couldn't miss. And he did. And you just wonder if his career starts in Kansas City or San Diego or Pittsburgh, does he have another level of career? Because there was clearly greatness in his, in especially his hitting skill level.
Yeah, and you point out his career wasn't terrible. I mean, he wound up with a .289 overall batting average career, which is not bad, but it's not great. It's not Hall of Fame caliber, and that was the path that they thought he was on, that McElvain, at least, and others thought he was on, and he never really achieved it. Joel, let me get up to date now on things. I mean, the owners are going to present tomorrow, we're told, their proposal to the Players Association and Tony Clark and those folks, and they're going to try to hammer things out. We were talking to Eddie C. last hour, and he thought they really have just about a week or so to get this thing done if they're going to hope to start in July. Would you go along with that, and would you think that they're going to be able to achieve that?
So I think what I have thought almost from the beginning, which is if the virus allows them to play, and I think we're still being a little too heady here, like, well, like as long as they get through the financial stuff, they'll play. We still don't know what happened. You know, I'm in spring training every year when I hear, oh, those three players were sent home with flu-like symptoms. Like, this is a closed petri dish. And if one player gets something, it's very, very hard in a closed confines like this for multiple players not to get. Now, of course, they're going to try best practices. The 67-page document on health and safety was impressive in its thoughtfulness and thoroughness. And maybe by wearing masks and having best sanitation, et cetera, they can stop contagion if indeed somebody in that universe. And I use the term universe purposely, Richard, because we can't just think of the players. You got to think of all the coaches. You got to think of trainers. You got to think of team doctors. You've got to think of clubhouse attendants, people who are serving food, et cetera. That's even if you're keeping the numbers tight, it's a large universe of people they will come in contact with, especially if they're not going to do like the NBA and do it in a bubble, but try to play in 30 different locales. I think if the virus gets solved, which is something unique in the history of the world, but certainly in Major League Baseball, then something they're used to doing, which is fighting over money but ultimately coming to an agreement, is something they'll get to. They do this every several years with the collective bargaining agreement, and a deadline makes them look at each other and not want to go into labor stoppage again, understanding the implications from all the times that happened pre-1995. And I think they look at each other, understand the historic importance of doing this, understand that there is some national patriotic value to what they'd be doing, and I think they'll agree to agree. But first, they'll do what they always do, because this is who they are. They're going to fight about the money.
And what I don't get, and I guess it's because, you know, they're individuals, but, you know, Blake Snell, people like that, going public with this stuff, you're not going to get public sympathy to your side with if you're a player, whether their cause is just or not. People are going to say, hey, these guys are making millions of dollars and we're out of a job and our jobs may not be there when we come back. And these players can't even take a reduction in their millions and millions of dollars. So I'm surprised that they don't understand that at this point. They can make their case privately behind closed doors, but to go public just seems to be a real lose-lose proposition.
Yeah, well, Richard, I think most people know they should be wearing masks outside, but a couple of people don't. Would you describe everyone as foolish? I think a couple of players have said some things, and I am a player's guy. What they get. In this situation, they'll also be the people taking the risk. I don't expect that we're going to be seeing owners in the middle of clubhouses. And so whatever they get, they get. But I think we all understand. Most of us played baseball as a kid, and most people foolishly believed I would do that for free. You wouldn't. You know, if you were doing it every day and you had reached the top of the field and it was in a good year, an $11 billion industry, you'd want your piece of the pie. So I never begrudge a player for going after it. I do think this is a moment in time where everyone shouldn't be talking about money publicly. Not when we have 3 to 35 million people filing for unemployment, people still dying at high levels across the country. This is one of those moments they needed to try to go do what they always do, which is fight about it, but do it behind closed doors. Doing it publicly when we have so many problems in the country, I think, is a mistake by either side, not just the players.
Yeah, very good point. Joel, as always, a pleasure. We got to do it again sometime soon. And good luck and keep writing those great stories.
All right, Richard. All the best to you and your listeners, okay?
Okay. That's Joel Sherman from the New York Post with a great Greg Jeffries story, which you can get online still. You want to go back and read it. It's terrific.